I'm Julie Burstein. I'm in for Leonard Lopate on this gray afternoon. And since there's not much to do on gray afternoons, let's take the sofa in the living room and pretend it's an island and it's surrounded by a deep lagoon filled with sharks. And we have to get from here to the chair over there without falling in. Can you see them? Watch out. That's the kind of game I used to play many, many years ago with my neighbors and friends when it was raining outside and we couldn't play kickball or ride our bikes. And maybe it's what I've been lucky to be able to do, to grow up and be able to do on the radio sometimes. Make-believe can be magical. And today on Please Explain, we're going to talk about the meaning of that time in our lives and the role make-believe and play have in human development. Now, I just shared a little bit of my make-believe from my childhood. If you'd like to do the same, you can go to our show page at WNYC.org. And we're also going to be taking calls in a couple of minutes at 212-433-9692. With me to talk about make-believe are two experts on this subject. On the phone, Dr. Elizabeth Goodnow is the editor of Secret Spaces of Childhood and the author of the forthcoming A Place for Play, a companion volume to the Michigan Public Television film Where Do the Children Play? The book is available from the University of Michigan Press. And Dr. Susan Lin is a psychologist and associate director of the Media Center at Judge Baker's Children's Center at Harvard University and the director of a campaign for a commercial-free childhood. Her most recent book, The Case for Make-Believe, Saving Play in Our Commercialized World, is available from the New Press. Elizabeth, Susan, welcome to the Leonard Lopate Show.
I'm so happy to be here with you.
Thank you, Jennifer. It's great to be here.
Now, for the purposes of our discussion, maybe we should begin by talking about what we mean when we say make-believe. How do you define make-believe, Dr. Lin?
Well, make-believe actually is play that involves pretending or transformation. And so I think what we really have to do is start out by talking about play and what and sort of describe what play is. And that's actually more complicated, because although most of us play, it's easy for us to take it for granted, but it's kind of hard to describe and to understand and to really think about what play means. I think the first thing we have to do is accept that it's actually paradoxical. A lot about it is paradoxical. So, for instance, play is inherently satisfying and has no goal other than the experience of playing. When the end result becomes more important than the experience, well, then we're not playing, we're actually working.
So that
the seed of our greatest accomplishments emerges when we're playing.
How does that happen, that our greatest accomplishments come out of play, when we're not directed towards them?
I think that that's another kind of paradox about play, is that that happens because it takes place in the intersection of our inner world with the outer world. And so it's simultaneously real and not real at the same time. I mean, what I mean is it takes place in time and space, in that we're doing something. We're not just sitting there daydreaming. And in that sense, it exists outside of ourselves, but it's not wholly outside. And it doesn't have the same consequences as the things that we do that are wholly outside of ourselves. And so it's safe. It takes place in play is safe. When you play, if you make a mistake, it doesn't have the same consequences as making a mistake in real life. And so it's a chance to be able to try out things, and it's a chance to really bring forth our most inner and precious selves in a way.
Dr. Goodnow, would you have anything to add to that idea of play?
Well, one of the things I discovered when I was investigating secret spaces of childhood is that there's a really profound connection between storytelling and the kinds of forts and hideouts and away spaces that children seek out on their own, and that a lot of times adults don't realize how important that weaving of a boundary or a kind of negotiating a space that Susan was talking about between the me and the not me, and how that gets created, moved, established. It's kind of a porous boundary, and interestingly, children often seek out those borderlands, like the couch you're talking about.
Yes.
That's sort of an island or an away space that is not where all the human traffic is.
Yes.
Because they kind of need that.
I remember from my days of make-believe, that was often what we did, is we are stranded on a desert something or other, and we are away from everybody else.
That's a great analogy, because, you know, the writer James Barry, the author
yes.
of Peter Pan, wrote an introduction to The Boy Castaways, and he said in that, you know, to be born is to be wrecked on an island. And that sort of, you know, thrown quality, the fact that we have absolutely no choice as a child of where we are cast, I think is something that often adults don't fully recall.
You know, when I look at my own children play today, they often find either the space under the forsythia that only they can fit in to create their little worlds, or they have games, and sometimes they go there by themselves, or they have games with their friends where they're building castles out of their Legos and using their Pokemon to create all of these various wars and things going on.
Mm-hmm.
Is there a difference between, can you have make-believe alone as well
oh,
as make-believe with friends?
You can have both, and I think it's really important to give children the opportunity to have both. I mean, one of the things that about make-believe is that children can, if they're given the opportunity, they can spend, you know, incredible amounts of times by themselves, you know, playing with blocks or building with Legos or, you know, playing with dolls or stuffed animals or making up stories or, you know, all sorts of things like that. And they can do that by themselves. And it's one of the ways, I think, that giving children that opportunity to play by themselves is one of the ways that we learn to get to know ourselves and to be able to spend time by ourselves. I think that's really important. But at the same time, there is, you know, also incredible delight in playing with other people as well, incorporating other people into our play. And that's, you know, the way that children learn a lot about socialization and negotiation and working together, all sorts of things like that.
Negotiation was the word I was going to use in watching my kids play with their friends. That's often very heated, is, no, I said that we're actually knights. No, I said we're actually Marines. And so it is then negotiating whose make-believe are we going to be inhabiting here?
Yeah, and how about I'm first?
That is always a constant, even as the kids get older. And I think even in even when you're a grown-up, that seems to carry over. How do make-believe and play connect with how we develop as people?
Well, I think that make-believe and our capacity to play is really central to what's best about being human. I mean, babies are born with this incredible potential, this mechanism that facilitates problem solving and creativity and self-reflection and the capacity to make meaning in the world. And it's really that potential is inherent in all of us. And then, you know, whether or not, you know, it develops or how it develops really depends on our environment. And I really like to turn to D.W. Winnicott, who was this wonderful pediatrician and psychoanalytic practitioner in the mid-20th century, who really, I think, just carved out a space for play and did just a lovely job of explaining how it develops. And what he talks about is that it starts with babies, and it starts with a baby in relationship. He would say a mother. It was the 50s, so we feminists hadn't sort of emerged yet. So he would say a mother. We could say parents. But it starts in the context of a loving relationship. And what happens is that Winnicott's the one who coined the term good enough mothering or good enough mm-hmm. parenting. You know, you don't have to be perfect. You just have to be good enough.
Yes.
Which I find very comforting. And so, you know, that you have a baby being held, and parents instinctively know not to hold a baby too tight. If you hold a baby too tight, the baby can't move and can't explore. But if you hold a baby too loosely, the baby sort of flails around
and doesn't feel secure.
Falling, actually, mm-hmm. So maybe even rather afraid to move. But if you hold a baby just, you know, so the baby feels safe but has room to move, what happens is that the baby makes some kind of a gesture that seems different from random flailing. And what happens is that we kind of instinctively respond. We sort of go, oh, or ah, you know, baby goes, eh, or something like that, and moves her hand, and we respond. And that's the first experience of our being able to create something good in the world, which is really sort of the foundation of play. And it's the beginning of being able to separate ourselves from our environment. And in order to play, we have to be able to have a sense of who we are and what's true for us, as opposed to the rest of the world.
You know, and I think about some of the first games we play with babies, which are pretending, where you put your hands in front of your face and then open them and say peekaboo.
Right.
You're pretending that you're disappearing and then you're reappearing.
Right. And what's so interesting about that, I mean, babies at a certain age can play that, you know, just really forever, to the point where, you know, parents really sort of want to throw up their hands. But that's the other thing about play, is that we when we're really playing creatively, we're playing out the sort of psychological tasks that we're working on. And babies who like to play make-believe are in the process of sorting out their separation from their parents, and they're sorting out whether things that disappear will actually come back again.
Mm-hmm.
So in a way, in playing that, it's a way of gaining mastery and being able to gain competence around an idea or, you know, a problem that we're working on or some developmental task.
I'm speaking with Dr. Liz Goodnow and Dr. Susan Lin about play and make-believe. You know, you just mentioned about the task, and this is for either of you, but at the beginning we talked about play as something that doesn't have an end goal, yet it sounds like in the great scheme of things, play does have an end goal, which is developmental. It's not something where we say, we have to master this by next Thursday in order to be able to do X, but we have to play in order to develop as full human beings.
I think that's a really important point, and it goes back to the idea of play as paradox, because the goal, inherent in play is learning. And one of the problems we have today is that we, you know, we don't really allow children to play. And there's, you know, in schools there's all this push towards rote learning and academic learning, even in preschool. And what we really need to do, though, I think, is trust that playing in and of itself is learning. When children are playing and they're intent on playing, they're growing and developing. And it's an inborn capacity if we would just let them do that.
We're going to be taking your calls in a couple of minutes. If you have any questions about play and make-believe for my guests, give us a call at 433-9692. That's 212-433-WNYC. Now, what has the kind of proliferation of directed play done to the way that we use our imaginations? I think about the world I grew up in the 60s, where I had Disneykins, which were figures from Disney, but then I created my own imaginary play around it. I look at my two boys, though, and the kind of influx of toys and the way that they play. They still have a lot of things that they do on their own, but there's a lot more to direct them to a particular character or a particular scenario. Is that true overall, or am I just looking at it in my family?
Go ahead. Liz, do you want to go ahead and take that?
Liz, why don't you take that one?
Okay. I just want to say that, you know, when we talk about make-believe, and the kinds of spontaneous play that children will engage in when they're feeling comfortable and safe. Often we don't really understand, I think, that they're operating at really, in my mind, the highest level of being human, and that this isn't just kind of a illusory, trivial game. You know?
Or what you do when you're not doing something else.
Exactly. It's not just a diverting interest. It's in fact a quality of real life and enriching and expanding the most essential qualities of being human. And it's that sense that there's something more, the capacity to create new images and understanding of what that more can be, that is the most profound and important thing in human life. And if a child at an early stage is blocked from that kind of touchstone within themselves, that fountain of becoming, it's deadening. We as Susan says, with all the directed learning, are really creating almost robotic, automatic pilot people, where the imagination is sorely challenged and blocked. And it's one of the reasons that I think William Blake capitalized it. I mean, he saw it as a divine quality, as the God within. And so, I mean, I can't say enough about how important this is, because we're all going to develop in different ways, and we can talk about different developmental paradigms, but ultimately this capacity is able to put us in touch with the vast space and possibilities of all of life. And I feel we're really narrowing those capacities right now in childhood.
I absolutely agree with Liz, and I think that the combination of ubiquitous and incredibly sophisticated media and unfettered commercialism is really a disaster for children. And in part because it really impinges on their experience of playing and really it's funny. I mean, we're at a point in society where we actually prevent children from playing. As a society, we prevent children from playing, and in a way, we've gotten to a point where nurturing creative play has become countercultural because it's not lucrative. It doesn't. Children who play creatively don't need the things, as many of the things, or any of the things really, that corporations sell us today. And they don't need the things that dominate the toy market. And it's very troubling to me, and it's why I wrote the case for make believe, is because it's just so ironic to me that here's what Liz calls the God within, and we're actually preventing children from accessing that.
We have to go to a break in a moment, but let me ask you one very, very directed question, which is, in this world, which, unless we move to someplace where there is no television or computer games or all of those things, this is the world that we as parents live in. In this world, how do we create a space for our children to be able to access that well of make-believe and play?
And did you want to answer this before the break?
if you can give me a quick answer, and then I think actually I'm looking at the questions. We're going to go to questions. We have many questions that go even more specific than that from our listeners. But if you have answer.
I think that that we can't assume anymore that children completely, left on their own, are playing creatively as if they're immersed in a media culture, and that we have to do two things, or several things. One is we really have to limit, with young children especially, we have to limit the kinds of media their exposure to media. We need to limit the kinds of the electronic toys that we give kids today. I think that time and space outside is important. Essentially, we have to be conscious of giving kids time, space, tools, not toys that do everything for them, but toys that they can act on, and silence.
And I just want to add that when Susan describes a mother holding a baby, you know, if the mother is clutching because she inwardly is clutching, that will change that initial exchange. And I really think adults have to embody the kinds of aliveness that they want to share with their children. And that's as easy or as hard as breathing, opening the windows, going outside, being alive to your own sensual experience, and maybe also recognizing, as Susan is suggesting, that the electronic managers have won and that we have to take back the night. You know, we have to be very aware of our own cramped and accelerating consciousness.
I'm speaking with Dr. Liz Goodnow of the University of Michigan and Dr. Susan Lin of Harvard, and we're talking about make-believe and play. I'm Julie Burstein in today for Leonard Lopate, and I hope you'll stay tuned and give us a call at 433-9692.
See, but it wouldn't be make-believe if you believed in me.
I'm Julie Burstein. I'm in for Leonard Lopate today, and I'm speaking with Dr. Liz Goodnow of the University of Michigan and Dr. Susan Lin of Harvard about play and make-believe, two things that I love still to do as a grown-up. And we have time now for a couple of questions from our audience, so I'd like first to go to Maggie in Brooklyn. Maggie, you had a question for our guests.
Yeah, hi. It's actually related to something that your guest was talking about. I love to play with my two little girls, and my daughter's birthday is coming up in 2 weeks. She's turning four, and I'm going to make this elaborate tea party, a dress-up tea party. And living in Brooklyn and living in New York, you'd think that there'd be so many places that kids can access their imagination through dress-up and through make-believe, and there really isn't. And to me, it's just a shame because the market is so ripe for it.
You know, I've heard about City Lore, and isn't that in Brooklyn? There's some placemaking festival activities connected with that website you might want to check out.
That sounds good.
And there's a wonderful book called Hidden New York, which deals with places and the kinds of, you know, public spaces and cultural events that can happen in very small spaces, actually, in the nooks and crannies of where you live.
Right. Well, that's the whole idea, that everything is so small. You know, usually when I was a kid, I would love to go outside and play in the open, and I just find that those spaces are just becoming, you know, more and more rare.
Well, they certainly are in Detroit, where we have 90 pocket parks up for sale. You know, one person's pocket park is another person's eyesore, and what we really need are neighbors to get together with children, families, animals, maybe plans for a community garden or a tea party under the remaining bush or tree to give a sense of what that place can mean to the surrounding families and individuals. And in many ways, the elderly can be brought in as the natural play workers here, people who just enjoy hanging out and watching children play and reassuring parents that this is a safe space.
You know, does space matter for children playing? I mean, I think about my own childhood, and there were days where we were cooped up in a very small playroom, and we could have been sailing on an ocean with nothing on the horizon.
I think that that space matters in that children need safe. They need to be safe.
Like the baby, they need safety regardless of how old they are.
Right. Yes. Mm-hmm. Yes. It needs to be. They need to be safe. But also, I think that in addition to physical space, we really have to think about psychological space
mm-hmm.
for playing. And when children are constantly bombarded with sound, if the television's on all the time, if all of their toys chirp and beep and make noise, and there's constant stimulation, they don't have the space or the opportunity to be able to generate what's inside of them, to bring what Winnicott talks about, we play in the service of the dream, to bring their dreams out and to into the world and to play about them and for them.
The concept of the tea party is wonderful because as the children move into it with you, it's not just taking place in time and space, but it's kind of creating its own time and space. The way, Susan, I've had the privilege of seeing your puppet Audrey speak with a group of people, and automatically, you know, maybe at the tea party there can be a talking bear and some puppets or all kinds of invitees who create a whole new intersubjective space.
And I think that Liz is raising another really good point, and that is that that one thing that adults can do in this world that is really, as I said, preventing children from playing is to, if they're comfortable, to be playful. I mean, you can make a stuffed animal talk, you know, instead of punching a button and having, you know, the chip inside the bear, you know, generate noise or talking or things like that. You can use puppets. You can, you know, make, you know, all sorts of things talk.
And do we as parents need to...
My daughter's peas talk to her when she was eating them. Sasha, your peas are calling you, you know.
And, you know, just as you did with your daughter, is part of our responsibility as parents now, given that everything talks without anybody making them do that, to model that for our kids and to be those talking stuffed animals for them so that they can then see that that's possible?
I think so. Now, not everybody's comfortable doing that, but everybody's got some kind of playful quality, and often it's around art. If you love music, play around music. If you love art, you know, have lots of art supplies, not kits that are predetermined, you know, that
you
really
fill
limit
in the spaces.
Your choices.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, clay, paint, paper, glue, and if that's what you love to do, then do that with your children.
Yeah, I think that's a really good point. You have to be comfortable with what you're doing, but whether it's puppetry or breathing life into a drawing, sitting at the little tea table, drawing with the children where you are, it's a way of enhancing the experience and then having a souvenir and memento to remember this wonderful birthday, and there are kind of layerings of it all. And, you know, you can make a puppet out of anything.
A paper bag, a sock, a mug
with reading glasses taped over its nose. I mean, you know, anything can be breathed life into if, as an adult, we're kind of in the moment.
Let's go to another question from a listener. Karen from Pompton Plains, you're on the Leonard Lopate Show.
Hi. I have a couple of, well, I could talk to these ladies all day.
Me too.
I have a daughter who's almost 10. She's an only child, and she can play by herself for hours and hours and hours. But I found that she does have difficulty. Her teacher was telling me the other day in school she was having difficulty compromising working in a group. So that was one issue. And then I also had a question. She loves the American Girl dolls, and the doll comes with a history lesson, basically. They come with 6 books, or you can purchase 6 books that go along. So Felicity is from Williamsburg, and Addie went on the Underground Railroad to, you know, escape slavery. And I was wondering what they think of those dolls and that concept.
Well, I'm kind of ambivalent about the American Girl dolls. I'm drawn to them, you know, the way that they look, and I think they're neat in that way. They're incredibly expensive, which troubles me. On the other hand, they're certainly not Barbie or the Bratz dolls. They're not sexualized. I think that that you know, having a doll and having a book to go with the doll, that's fine, and that can because then children can take off from that and play all sorts of things with the doll. What's more troubling is when the doll is a doll that they also see on television or that's from the movies, for instance. And American Girl dolls are actually starting to make television programs. Once they see the doll move and talk and come to life on the screen, that tends to overwhelm children's own imagination, and their play tends to become more scripted.
Is it the same?
I find that really troubling.
For seeing movies of a favorite book, I mean, how does reading play into this life of play and make-believe?
Well, can I answer this one?
Yes, please.
Yeah, please.
You know, I think, now, Karen's daughter is 10, so she's probably not sitting on your lap anymore, but she's certainly sit next to you and share these books, and you can talk about them. And, you know, I really think that it's that space, that sphere of interaction between an adult and a child when a book is shared and the pages are turned and the words are savored in your mouth, and you know, you can even share the reading of it. And all of that is one of the most precious spaces that we have of shared storytelling. Of course, you know, if the parent also shares their own stories or helps interpret, I mean, if this American Girl doll has a history that connects to the family or the grandparents or a geographical site that the family knows, I mean, all of these are ways of weaving a fabric that a child can enter and never leave, feels cloaked in and part of. And you know, it's really most about that sort of contextual space and building it incrementally over time that's, I think, so important. And the best children's books, big surprise, I mean, they're by storytellers, are really about that intertextuality of about how stories are created. So you'll find, you know, islands where that process is really epitomized, whether it's, you know, Robinson Crusoe or Neverland, where stories are made up as the stuff of life. So I would say to Karen, the more you and your child can share stories, and there's a process of negotiating those. She may become less resistant to controlling everything if you and she kind of duke it out in gentle ways as you explore the stories that she's understanding about her American Girl doll. It's really a co-creating process, I think, how play evolves. And I think that adults can share in this to some degree.
We just have a couple of minutes left, but that was what I was going to end with, which is we talk a lot about the value of play for children, but what's the value for us?
It's what makes life meaningful. It's the way that we find meaning in life. It's a source of incredible joy and our own creativity, and it's in creativity, in being creative, that we can really be ourselves. I mean, play is really essential for health.
I also feel that, you know, for a long time we've hidden what Susan is saying from ourselves by saying it's something children need to do,
mm-hmm.
and yet we sort of bootleg what they're doing to justify our creativity, our leisure time, our maybe writing of a children's book. I mean, many of the greatest children's books have been written by authors, quote-unquote, for their own children. It's really for themselves, and I think we need to understand that sometimes children also need space apart from us to explore and investigate their own inner reality with their peers or by themselves.
Well, Dr. Lynn and Dr. Goodenough, thank you so much for joining me today to talk about make-believe. We have 30 seconds. What should we go and do, each of us now, just to give us a minute of play before we have to go back to our jobs?
Turn off the radio, turn off the television, you know, find some silence and see what happens from there.
I would say go outside and take some deep breaths and tell yourself where later in the day, you're not just going to take a minute, you're going to lose track of time altogether.
Dr. Liz Goodenough of the University of Michigan and Dr. Susan Lynn of Harvard, thank you again for talking about two wonderful subjects, play and make-believe, here on The Leonard LoPage Show.
Thank you, Julie.
Thank you.
It's been a pleasure. On Monday's show, David K. Johnston of the New York Times on why he thinks the American tax system is inherently unfair and why it should be changed quickly. Also, an update on Generation X, then actress and singer Victoria Clark on her debut album, 15 Seconds of Grace, plus a look at Tokyo's cultural elite. The Leonard LoPate Show is produced by Blakeney Schick, Sarah English, and Scott Goldberg. Melissa Egan is the executive producer. We had help today from John Cottrell and contributing producer Bonnie Lefebvre and Julia Corcoran. Debbie Daughtry was at the audio controls. I'm Julie Burstein in today for Leonard LoPate. Thanks for listening, and have a great weekend.